Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenney. Coming up on today's program, Dayton Youth Radio, we've also got WISO's occasional art series, Culture Couch. Up first, more than a dozen elderly homeowners in Dayton's Westwood neighborhood have been selected by the nonprofit Rebuilding Together Dayton to receive home repairs for no charge. The event in West Dayton, Saturday, April 29th, is part of a nationwide annual event made possible by about 100,000 volunteers across the country. At a fundraising event on Thursday, we spoke to Westwood homeowner Dorothy Thompson, who was one of the homeowners selected in the last year by the Dayton chapter. She supports her disabled daughter on a low fixed income. Her home was in desperate need of repairs, and with little financial support, Thompson felt stuck. She says she could not have done herself what volunteers from Rebuilding Together Dayton did for her.
Young people that they selected from different, you know, different schools and everything, they were so polite and so generous. They were eager, you know, to do what to do next. And I appreciate all of it.
RT Dayton's Amy Radacci says the goal of the repair program is to help elderly homeowners remain independent and avoid moving to expensive assisted living facilities. She says many of the homeowners chosen for repairs are longtime stable residents.
Well, the homeowners that we serve want to age in place. They don't want to leave their homes. They don't want to go to an assisted living facility. And honestly, they can't afford to. So we can go in and make modifications and repairs that will allow them to age in place. That's the rewarding part.
All right. What has been accomplished in the last year?
Well, in 2016, we were able to serve 136 unduplicated homes with 205 residents across the Montgomery County.
Unduplicated means because you quite often go back to the homes several times.
Right. Sometimes they might need a grab bar or a handrail, and in the fall we do heat the town, so we revisit a lot of the homeowners that we've served with furnace tune-ups and checks.
Let's talk a little bit about economics and funding that's needed for all this to happen.
The average cost of a modification is about $5,000 when you're talking about a step-in shower or a wheelchair ramp. So there is a cost to all of the work that we do. All of our volunteers are great to do the labor, and we really generate another $4 in in-kind labor and materials with every dollar we raise.
This year's event is coming up on the last Saturday in April.
Correct. National Rebuilding Day is Saturday, April 29th in the Westwood neighborhood. We consider Westwood a high opportunity neighborhood. There are a lot of elderly homeowners who've been in their homes an average of 30 to 40 years. They're on a fixed income and they can't afford to make repairs that would allow them to stay there. So we're happy to go in and do what we can to make them safer.
And let's talk about the actual day. What's going to take place? How many volunteers are you going to have or hoping for?
Well, we will be working on 15 houses on April 29th in the Westwood neighborhood, and we anticipate between 700 and 800 volunteers.
And how can folks take part in National Rebuilding Day?
Well, we would happily invite the community to participate. They can sign up online on our website at rtdayton.org, and they can choose to volunteer on the website, and they can participate on any 5 Saturdays in April if we have opportunities for them.
Great. Amy Radacci, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jerry.
Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley was also on hand at the event, and we spoke to her about the importance of nonprofits like Rebuilding Together Dayton.
We like when folks and our seniors are in our neighborhoods. They are great eyes and ears and great leaders with young people, and really have great inspiration in our neighborhoods. And when, you know, it's hard for them to get upstairs or hard for them to use their bathtub that was easy to get in before, Rebuilding Together provides a service both with the support they get from this breakfast and then with volunteers all across the community coming in and making, you know, great changes in our housing.
Services like this from a nonprofit organization, we just talked to the homeowner. These services mean a lot to these people and for their quality of life here in Dayton.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think what's so great about Rebuilding Together is, you know, for every dollar that's put in, there's 4 hours of volunteer time that's put in too. So the multiplier for these donations are really enormous. And then they're engaging community. And, you know, our community is stronger when people are really engaged in it. And when we have nonprofits working to do that engagement, it's second to none.
I don't know if it's ever been done or probably hard to quantify the economic impact that multiple organizations like Rebuilding Together Dayton has on the city and how it correlates to the city budget. What if these nonprofits weren't operating in the city?
It would be a big challenge. I mean, I think both Rebuilding Together and People Working Cooperatively, that does a different kind of work, but another housing work, they've actually done studies that showed how they stabilize property values across the county and across the city. That property value helps support our schools, our human service levy, and provides much-needed services across the community for folks that are in need and for education. So, yeah, so that, you know, keeping someone in their home, making sure their home has value, helps us overall on not just the community being stronger, but then also at large, the community being stronger for those values for our property.
And separate from organizations like Rebuilding Together, what's taking place within city government for communities like Westwood?
We have this West Dayton framework that Commissioner Shaw and John Lumpkin are co-chairing, really discussing how we can redefine and relook at these neighborhoods with the neighborhoods in process. So from DeSoto Bass to Highland, and then also the work in Westwood has been key for that. So we really lead those conversations, and the nonprofits are key in that effort. We give about $55,000 a year to Rebuilding Together Dayton through our CDBG budget, which is the Community Development Block Grant, which is on the table right now in the federal budget. But that grant, think of what the multiplier that is for this effort. And, you know, the city couldn't do that without Rebuilding Together. So it's a great investment for us to really make sure that these neighborhoods stay strong.
And again, information on National Rebuilding Day can be found at rtdayton.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. In this week's Politics Ohio, Karen Kassler talks about legislative initiatives on opiate prescription regulations, green energy standards being talked about at the State House, and up first, passage of Ohio's transportation budget, which happened after some compromises in the House and Senate were hammered out.
So what we end up with here is a $7.8 billion transportation budget, which is separate from the big state budget that Governor Kasich put out a couple weeks ago, back in January, that he'll talk about in his State of the State speech coming up this coming week, and that the House and Senate will also have to put out their versions of coming up later on in April and May. All that has to be signed and in place by the end of June. But the transportation budget specifically goes for road construction, bridges, and infrastructure projects like that, and that is on its way to the governor to be signed right now.
And likely no problems there.
Right. I mean, there was a couple of things in here that got some people a little bit concerned. There was some money that was stripped out, $48 million that was earmarked for local road and bridge projects, $30 million that was earmarked for public transit. That had been added by the Senate. That was taken out. There's also a way that counties can now charge an additional $5 for vehicle registrations to go toward bridge and road construction. A lot of this goes to the issue of the gas tax and how that revenue has been falling off over the years because cars are more efficient, people are using less gas, and so there's a continuing conversation here about how to fund road construction when the main avenue toward it, which was the gas tax, is really falling off.
Let's talk about the opioid crisis. A lot in the news about this continues. What's happening with the legislature?
Well, there were two big things that happened this week. A group of Republican lawmakers proposed a bill that would put some limits on prescriptions for opioid painkillers, things like OxyContin. And right now, the state guidelines say you can prescribe 144 pills over a three-month period. And these lawmakers want to scale that back to the federal Centers for Disease Control guidelines, which is 24 pills over a three-month period. So from 144 down to 24, that's a much, much smaller number. And the day after that, Governor Kasich came out with his own rule proposal, which moves a little bit faster because it doesn't have to go through the legislature. This would put a limit of 7 days of prescription painkillers for adults, 5 days for minors, and that doctors could not prescribe these 30-day painkiller prescriptions, send patients home with a big bottle of painkillers. The whole idea being people can get addicted to these things. Once they're addicted and then their supply is cut off, they can turn to things like heroin, and that's where we really get into some major problems.
Any pushback from medical associations on this yet?
Oh, sure. The doctors' associations are very concerned about any rule that does a one-size-fits-all approach. They want to make sure that they still maintain the ability to prescribe patients who have cancer, patients who are in hospice, the kind of painkillers they need. The governor's rule does allow for that, for people in hospice care and in special circumstances to be prescribed those medications. But it still brings up the whole question, and this is kind of new in the whole opioid debate, at least from the State House perspective. Let's talk about the role that doctors are playing here, not the pill mills, but doctors who are operating in doctor's offices around the state, are there the appropriate rules on those doctors to make sure that their patients aren't getting addicted? And if they are, what happens to them?
All right. And there's some movement on some green energy standards, I understand.
Indeed. We've been talking about this for the last five General Assemblies now, for like 9 years. And this is a law that goes back to 2008 that said that electric utilities had to get a certain percentage of their power from green energy sources. Well, now the House has voted to change that. It would change those requirements back to or into goals, so that there would be no penalties attached if indeed an electric utility did not meet the state's requirement. There would be no punishment for that. The whole idea is that Republicans say that these standards were expensive for the utilities and for customers, and that utilities are meeting those standards anyway. Democrats are very concerned about the future of the green energy industry in Ohio and say that these standards were the kind of things that kept green energy going and improved the climate and that sort of thing.
All right, and you mentioned the State of the State speech. I believe that's April 4th. What's the details on that?
Well, that's in Sandusky. It's 7 o'clock on Tuesday evening, and we expect the governor to talk about his budget because the House version of the budget should be coming out fairly shortly. We also expect him to talk about opioids and the crisis that's going on there, perhaps infant mortality, because Sandusky has a very high infant mortality rate in that county, and so we expect to hear a little bit maybe about that. And also the governor has been giving out what he calls courage awards to people who he admires their work, and so I can expect that there would be some courage awards as well. Some past winners have included Neil Armstrong. His family accepted after he passed away.
Karen Kassler with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for the update.
Hey, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Dayton has an eclectic population of independent fashion designers and craftspeople. Today on Culture Couch, Community Voices producer Renee Wild introduces two local independent business owners who are carving out a niche for themselves with the support of each other and their local community.
It's the start of the work week, and at local designer and indie business owner Tracy McElfresh's house in Kettering, that means one thing.
We are having Crafty Monday. I am making an Insta dress, and LaWanda is making some of her art bags.
Usually she and I try to get together, and, you know, maybe another person, too, that wants to come over on Mondays and sew and, you know, just work on their craft.
Every Monday for the past 4 years, Tracy hosts an informal sewing party at her house. And today, she and fellow designer LaWanda Stonerock are gathered in the small kitchen for coffee before gearing up to have some fun working on their personal sewing projects. There's an ironing board set up in the kitchen, and the table is piled with fabric, patterns, and three sewing machines. Tracy and LaWanda are part of a small local community of independent craftspeople and designers. They met through a group called Handmade Dayton.
And then it was a group for people that had Etsy shop that were online. It was the first, like, huge handmade market.
And I started seeing what she was doing, and I got more inspired by that. So that's, you know, kind of where I started out, was just getting inspired by some of the other local artists.
Tracy's been an integral part of the local craft scene in Dayton. In addition to making about 65 dresses a year, Tracy teaches sewing classes throughout the community, makes vintage-era costumes for the historic Carillon Park, and serves on the Kettering Arts Council. Her mom got her hooked on sewing at a young age.
My family is originally from Puerto Rico. My grandmother came here in 1963, and she worked in the sweatshop sewing in the garment district of New York City. And she taught my mom to sew, and then my mom taught me to sew.
2017 is gearing up to be a big year for Tracy. She and her former business partner closed their four-year-old sewing and vintage fabric shop in the Oregon district called Sew Dayton. And now she's focusing on her new business, Tracy's Sewing Studio. Creating custom designs is one of her favorite things.
It can be very interesting. So sometimes it's custom wedding, if they want something vintage inspired or they want something themed. My favorite are the cosplay people. They're a lot of fun to work with.
What's cosplay?
Cosplay is kind of a new movement where people dress up as characters. And then they all meet and hang out in their characters and do photographs and things like that.
2017 is also a big year for LaWanda. She just quit her job to focus full-time on her line of messenger bags, wristlets, and beaded necklaces.
I started really getting into this about 6 years ago. I did work for a retail place for 16 years, and I sewed at that time too, but something was missing. You know, I needed that creativity. I really wanted to do this full time. I had cancer in 2013. So after I got through that, I thought, okay, it's time, LaWanda.
An essential part of LaWanda's cancer recovery was listening to her favorite band, Guided by Voices. So LaWanda was thrilled that she's going to be making custom record bags for the band.
I met a non-dairy creamer explicitly laid out like a fruitcake.
The first couple of months were really scary. I'm grateful, you know, for every day that I can do this. So this year is going to be my year. So right now I have 46 items in stock and I'm building every day.
Tracy and LaWanda both say that being involved with other artists in the local design community is the key to success.
Mary Catherine Burnside has a show twice a year called Clash, the Clash Fashion Show, and I've met a lot of designers through there, and a lot of people that design, if they're just getting into designing, it's a good way for them to meet other designers and build their skills. I also have a group called the Dressmaker Meetup. We meet every 4 months. It's gender-friendly, male and female, any skill level, and the best way to increase your knowledge of how to make something is to surround yourself with people that are doing it.
You can inspire them, and, you know, it just spreads from there, and we love what we do.
Tracy McElfrish will be one of the featured demonstrators at the upcoming CraftyCon in the Yellow Cab building in Dayton on April 7th. You can find LaWanda Stone Rock's custom design bags locally at Urban Handmade in Yellow Springs, which features over 65 local designers. For WYSO's Culture Couch, I'm Community Voices reporter Renee Wild.
Every street is dark and foreboding. Atmosphere is
lit. To see photos of Tracy and LaWanda's projects, go to our website at WYSO.org. Culture Couch is our occasional series on the arts made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council.
Everybody's got to hold on, hope. It's the last thing that's holding me. Invitation to the last dance. Then it's time to leave. That's the prize.
Drag performances happen regularly all around Ohio, as they have for many years. Men dressed as women with elaborate and sometimes outrageous hair, costumes, and makeup perform on stages in clubs in Columbus, Cleveland, and Cincinnati, but also in smaller towns like Lima and Monroe. Dayton has its own drag tradition. Community Voices producer Eva Buttacavoli talked to some local drag performers for a glimpse of what it takes to prepare for a show.
So anyone that knows me knows I'm a girly girl. I love to dress up, I love heels, and I know my way around a pair of Spanx. And I love drag. I mean, who else takes girly girl to this level? These are my people. And here I live in Dayton, Ohio, and drag is out in Dayton. I asked three of the best in town their tips and tricks. And let me tell you, girls, drag queens are queens for a reason. They know their stuff. First, the hair. So much hair. No, not the wigs, but you know, the hair on guys. I asked drag performer in Miskay, Ohio, Eric Williams, about it.
Very, very, very first thing that I would do, assuming that I haven't been in drag for like a month, I'm hairy, all of that, I would go into the bathroom, strip down, and cover myself wherever I'm not supposed to have hair with feet. Legs, underarms, that sort of thing, chest, tummy. And while that's setting, I'm going to shave and get all the hair off my face.
Then there's Brent Johnson and Jonathan McNeil. Two drag artists, from Dayton's popular comedy drag troupe, the Ruby Girls.
I am not a leg shaver. I have very little chest hair, so just a quick swipe and I'm done on my chest. Very little leg hair, but I don't shave my legs. I just do 3 pair of pantyhose, sheer to waist, nude.
So I don't shave my legs. I don't shave anything. And, you know, armpits are hairy, chest is hairy.
All right, don't worry. We won't go any further into that. How about the body? I asked Eric how he creates that little waist in the womanly hips and butt. You know, the lumps and bumps I try to manage with Lycra.
You can find an old couch cushion or go to a craft store and find like the foam cushion that you would use for a couch. You would take a bread cutter and cut. It's basically the shape of like a kidney bean or I've heard some drag queens say the shape of Africa. You cut 2 of them out and you can layer up pantyhose over these hip pads that you would basically place over your hips and butt. Mm-hmm. And once you've got on enough pairs of pantyhose, sometimes it's like 7, 8, 12 pairs of pantyhose, they'll basically smooth out, and once you have on the rest of your clothing and everything, it just looks like a perfect hourglass figure.
So now I know. I also know it takes some ingenuity and foam rubber to keep the girls front and center. Here's Jonathan and Brent.
I have 2 Nerf balls that are cut in half that are tied together with a pantyhose and then knotted at the end to create a little ba-boom, a little nipple action. And then
I have my favorite pair of foam breasts that I made probably a decade ago or more. They look great. They're exactly the right size, so if I lose them, I'm going to be traumatized. But over the years, I've done bird seed. I've done water balloons, which can get real messy if you turn the wrong way.
Really?
Really.
Pretty inventive, huh? I think I'm pretty clever with a few safety pins or double stick. But in the dressing room of the Miss Gay Ohio pageant, I saw earrings glued on, waist girdled with saran wrap and duct tape. And yes, exactly what you're thinking. The securing of the boy parts. I asked Jonathan if he would tell me what he thought about it.
So I tuck my business away, but not as much. There are some queens who will tie it down and around and duct tape and
I've
all that.
I've heard duct tape and saran wrap stories. Yeah.
It sounds horrible.
I actually got to see that when I was at the pageant.
Yeah. It's.
I kept on reminding myself, I lived in Miami Beach in the 90s. I can deal with this, but wow.
Yeah.
So it's pretty funny when you think about it, isn't it? What we do to look a certain way. And we're not talking surgery here. We're talking self-expression, really. I asked Eric.
Imagine I didn't know what drag was. Explain what drag is.
So many different performers would say that it's so many different things. And one of the interesting things I've heard from a famous person, RuPaul, she says that everyone is born naked. And the rest is drag.
For YSO's Community Voices, I'm Eva Buttacavoli.
Find more Community Voices stories on our website at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenny. You're listening to YSO Weekend. Thanks so much for joining us. This week on Dayton Youth Radio, we have a story from a teenager who reflects on the decision that changed his life forever.
This is Seth McDermott. I'm a student at Centerville High School, and I'd like to share my story. I don't remember exactly when my mother and father told me I was adopted, but I do remember feeling special. I thought that being adopted was something to boast about. I distinctly remember coming into kindergarten one day and sharing the fact that I was adopted with everyone in the room. I remember running up to a mother who was dropping off her child and yelling at her and letting her know that I was adopted and telling her how special I was, and she knelt down and put her hand on my shoulder and let me know that everyone is special, no matter where they come from, who they are, or what color of their skin it is. I've kept that memory with me my whole life. Being adopted really didn't have any impact with me until I got a little bit older, around 12 or 13. I started asking my parents questions like, where am I from? Who are my parents? But I was never satisfied with the answers they gave me. One day at dinner, my mom told me that my biological mother had decided that she couldn't provide for me. She told me I had 5 sisters and 1 brother. I was thrilled when she told me this, because I was an only child at the time, and I always wanted to have siblings. Catholic Social Services was able to provide me with a profile paper. It gave out my biological mother's real name. I was the youngest out of the 7, because including me, 7. I noticed that my biological grandfather was a police chief. I decided just to look up past police chiefs of Dayton And, you know, I looked at their obituaries just to see if I could find my mother's name listed as their daughter, if I could, like, find out anything at all. I also learned that my biological family was from the west side of Dayton. My biological family only lived like 20 minutes away from where I was living with my adopted parents. Now, usually, when I think of West Dayton, it is probably the roughest, poorest part of Dayton. So just thinking about that does make me feel a little unsafe if I were to walk around there. Maybe it's ignorance, but that's how I envision it. I wouldn't say it's ignorance, maybe, just honesty. I mean, when I think of Centerville, which is where I've lived my whole life, I think about being comfortable and having really no worries at all. I love Centerville, and I love my friends there. I love my family. As you can see, there's a huge contrast between my thoughts of Centerville and West Dayton. That's when being adopted truly hit me. The fact that they only lived 20 minutes away made me think about it more. It made me think about how different my life would have been if my mother hadn't made the selfless decision to give me up. At the time of when I was given up, my mom was a single mother. She was working as a waitress at a local bar. She was an alcoholic. It was not a very good situation at all. My biological father and her split before I was even born. She knew she couldn't provide for me. She knew I would have better opportunities off if I were to be given up. So she made that decision. I don't know many mothers who would just openly give up their child just because maybe that child would have a better life somewhere else. I think that's one of the toughest things that anyone ever has to do is give up a child for adoption, because you know that person is a part of you. And then you're sending them off somewhere you don't know where. So right now, at the age of 17, in my senior year of high school, and knowing that I've been adopted for well over half my life, it's given me time just to reflect and just think about how different my life truly could have been if it wasn't for my biological mother. Sometimes when I'm alone, I just think about all the courage and strength that just took for my mother to make that decision. Honestly, I'm probably the biggest complainer in the world. I'll complain about everything, like school's too hard, my mom's too mean, there's nothing to do, I'm bored, yada, yada, yada. But in all honesty, I love my life, I love the people around me. I wake up almost every day with a smile on my face, except if it's school because no one wants to go there. It's, yeah, 20 minutes apart is just always going to stick with me because 20 minutes is not that long at all. And distance-wise, tiny. So one of the main things that's asked of me is, do you ever want to meet them, or do you have any plans on going to meet them? I'm really torn if I want to meet them or not. No, in all honesty, no. Scratch all that beforehand. My story is going to end with me meeting my biological family. That's how my story will end. For Dayton Youth Radio at Centerville High School, this is Seth McDermott.
That was a story entitled 20 Minutes Away, produced by Seth McDermott at Centerville High School. Special thanks to Trisha Raypock, broadcasting teacher at Centerville. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
You can hear more Dayton Youth Radio stories on our website or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Armott Boyer Charitable Trust, Fifth Third Bank trustee. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Thanks so much for joining us today. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with The Book Nook.